Everybody, and welcome. It's 11 o'clock, Wednesday, January 8th, 2020, and thanks for joining us for the 83rd episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. This will be our first show of 2020. Thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, aka the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. That was really pretty. As always, thank you. And if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So, as is sometimes the case on this show, I use this opportunity for a totally shameless self-promotional blurb. So, that was an excerpt from a song of mine called Heaven is a Lonely Place, which is sort of an existential view that a friend of mine once espoused about his view of the afterlife and heaven. And what's sort of an interesting sidebar to that is several years after that song was penned, he actually passed away in a car accident. So it's... Yeah, every time I play that, I think of him a lot, and that was many years ago, but I still remember him to this day, and he was played in bands with me before, a really good voice, and it was just a really sad incident, but be that as it may, it's a reflection of some of his existential struggles. And I think since we're going to be talking about some of that tonight, it was a kind of a nice topic relevant piece to bring to the table.
Absolutely. I can see that, definitely. As Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled 2 Minutes to Midnight, Terror Management Theory, with a nod to Iron Maiden, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So what I thought I'd do this evening is, talk about sort of I don't know how well known it is or not. Most people know the artist I'm going to talk about through his collaboration with a very, very well-known rock band. But folks may or may not know some of the intricacies of his and trivia aspects of some of his secondary and tertiary careers. So the artist that I'm referring to is Ritchie Blackmore, who most people know as one of the founding members and guitarist for Deep Purple. So Deep Purple were a band that started back in the late 60s and were through the 70s and actually have been in various incarnations, still in existence for quite a while, and then made a comeback in the 80s. But what I want to talk about is Ritchie Blackmore's second band after Deep Purple, which was Rainbow, more typically known as Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow or Blackmore's Rainbow. And most folks don't know this, but happened is there was a lot of turmoil in Deep Purple at the time, and particularly between Blackmore and lead singer Ian Gillan, who have had sort of an ongoing thing for a while. They still do. That's part of the reason that Blackmore isn't with Deep Purple anymore. They've had a long-standing feud, and I don't know the exact, because Blackmore says one thing and Gillan says something else, so it's just whatever. They've had a long-standing feud. So when early on, when he and the bass player left, Roger Glover left, because they joined as a pair. And the original, people talk about Deep Purple Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3, talking about the different configurations of lead singers that Deep Purple has had. So the first Mach 1 did not include Roger Glover or Ian Gillan, and they were more of a kind of one of the members, and I can't remember which one, I don't remember if it was John Lord or not, described them as sort of the British version of Vanilla Fudge, and that they did other people's songs and did kind of psychedelic covers of them. So when Nick Simper left, the lead singer and bass player, and I forgot the other guy's name that was with them, they left or were fired, I don't remember which, and they hired Ian Gillan and Roger Glover, lead singer, bass player. So when they left, they were replaced at the time by a then unknown lead singer who got his start with Blackmore. Blackmore started a lot of people's career. And the singer about whom I speak is David Coverdale, who, of course, everybody now knows, right? But at the time, nobody knew who the hell Coverdale was, and the bass player was replaced by Glenn Hughes, who at the time was playing with a three-piece band called Trapeze, which was a really good band, and Hughes was the vocalist bassist for Trapeze, and he left to go to Deep Purple, where he and Coverdale shared the vocal duties and did really, really, really well. The drummer, of course, for Trapeze went on to form Judas Priest. So he didn't fare too badly. At any rate, Coverdale and Hughes replaced Ian Gillan and Roger Glover. And then at some point, Blackmore got disgusted with the direction that the band was going with Coverdale in it, because Coverdale has a very different kind of voice than Ian Gillan. Both of them have very great voices, but very different. So he breaks off and joins in 75. He forms Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow, and essentially forms it out of members of a band called Elf, who not too many people know at the time, who at had an unknown singer, Ronnie James Dio.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
And Coverdale and so went on Dio, to Whitesnake, didn't he, I think?
So Dio went on to sing with Black Sabbath and then have a solo career. So after that, so what happened was he hired the members of Elf to do which started out to be kind of a solo project, and ended up firing everybody except Dio, and then, you know, formed the band Rainbow, and did most of the recording in February and March in 75, I think out of Munich, Germany. And the name was inspired, you know, he starts off with the Judy Garland Over the Rainbow thing, but that really wasn't what the name comes from. The name comes from the Rainbow Bar and Grill, which is a famous bar in West Hollywood, which is the same Rainbow Bar that is referred to in Warren Zevon's song, Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me. Where he met a gal at the Rainbow Bar. She asked me if I'd beat her. I love those lyrics. Anyway, not sung by Linda Ronstadt when she did that song. By the way, she changed the lyrics, which I felt was like, okay, you chickened out on me. Anyway, that's another story. Yeah, so another great vocalist in her own right. So Dio sings with Rainbow, and members come and go because Ritchie is notoriously has a reputation for being notoriously hard to work with, whether that's well-earned or not. Obviously, I don't know because I've never met the gentleman formally or played with him, unfortunately, which would have been, you know, a really cool honor. But anyway, he's had a lot of people in Rainbow, and they were really active between 75 and roughly 84. And the real reason they broke up in 84 is because Deep Purple got back together for their reunion with the original guys in the band. Now, by that time, Roger Glover, the bass player, was playing with Rainbow. So this is after he had had a number of bassists, including Jimmy Bain, who later went on to play with Ronnie James Dio's band. And, you know, a bunch of other folks. He had Matt Clark, who used to play with the band Coliseum, and Uriah Heep. So he's had a lot of very, you know, pretty good rock royalty, and started a lot of people's careers. He's had Cozy Powell on drums, who was a fabulous drummer, who's played with Jeff Beck and, you know, all sorts of folks, who unfortunately died early in a car wreck, but that's another story. Yeah. So, at any rate, they've gone through a lot of folks. He's had Bob Daisley on bass, and he got so disgusted in some of the stuff that he actually did some of the bass tracks himself in the studio. But live, he's had some really well-known bass players and drummers. So, and at some point, he got Graham Bonnet after Dio left. Supposedly, when Blackmore wanted to get away from the Dungeons and Dragons and mystical dillies and do more commercial stuff, Dio kind of said, "No, I'm out of here," and kind of left. And then, of course, did a stint with Black Sabbath, and then went out and did all his own thing, and has become a, you know, very popular vocalist in his own right. With his solo projects, and then has gone back and forth with Black Sabbath a couple of times. So when he left, he eventually got Grand Bonnet, who was the vocalist with Alcatraz, and got him to sing a couple of records, and has eventually got Jolyn Turner to come in to sing with him. And Jolyn Turner is probably, other than Dio, Jolyn Turner is probably the most well-known vocalist with Rainbow. He was the guy that did the, what was that top 40 song? Since You've Been Gone is Grand Bonnet. That was their big top 40 song with Grand Bonnet. Street of Dreams, that was the song that everybody knows with Jolyn Turner. Yeah, it's Jolyn Turner. He's a great vocalist. Great, great, great vocalist. And so that went on for a while until, as I said, Deep Purple go back together. And then in 87, after a while, You know, again, stuff kind of started back up with Deep Purple, and in 93 he left Deep Purple, Blackmore left Deep Purple again, and he's never gone back, and recreated Rainbow with a Scottish vocalist, Doogie White, who he's had on and off of them. Doogie White's also performed with Michael Schenker, and I think he's the current singer with Michael Schenker, who's also had a bunch of people, who's also a character in and of his own right, but this is not about Mr. Schenker this evening, but he is a fabulous guitarist also. At any rate, and then, of course, what happened was, eventually Ronnie James Dio decided he was tired of doing all this rock stuff and all this crazy stuff, and so he, in 97, he quit doing rock music altogether, and with his partner at the time, who was still his partner, Candace Knight, decided to go in a different direction, and he formed a band called Blackmore's Night, which does nothing but what I would call Baroque and Renaissance-style acoustic music, where Blackmore's playing acoustic guitar and lute and mandolin and all sorts of stuff, and Candace Knight's doing the vocals and percussion. She's a really good vocalist. And so they've been together for quite some time. Well, recently, and the reason I'm bringing... the reason I'm talking about Rainbow this evening, other than the fact that great band and Blackmore is obviously a very accomplished musician in his own right and has started the careers of a lot of folks, including Ronnie James Dio and David Coverdale. He decided to get back and play rock music after having not played rock music since like 93 or 97, excuse me. And in 2015, he decided to revive Rainbow. So they've been playing ever since, and Candace Knight's one of the backup vocalists with them, so she's still performing with Blackmore. The singer he's using now is Ronnie Romero, who sounds amazingly like Ronnie James Dio and makes no bones about it. And he's really, really good, and he's using on keyboards Jens Johansson, who is Stradivarius' keyboardist, who is just fabulous. Rainbow is out and doing its thing again. And I actually have heard they did a big Monsters of Rock festival thing, and then they did a big thing in, I think it was in South America. And I have a copy of a couple of the concerts that they've done, and just they're real, it's first-rate stuff. And the thing I like about it is he's doing homage to his entire career. So he's doing some Deep Purple stuff. He's doing some early Rainbow stuff with Dio, he's doing some Joel and Turner Rainbow stuff, so it's just it's really nice to hear all that stuff redone with Blackmore, who must be now in his 70s.
Wow.
And still out there playing and doing it, so I'm like, woo-hoo for you. That's awesome. And there's a lot of older rockers that are out there that are doing stuff, and that's not a slam, that's a tribute to them. You know, Geddy Lee being amongst them, and of course, you know, the Bobbsey twins, as I like to refer to them, Mick and Keith.
Oh.
we're still doing their things. I think they're lovingly referred to as the Toxic Twins, I think. But at any rate, so there's a lot of older rockers, Clapton, certainly. Tina Turner out there doing their thing. And just the thing I really love is a lot of those folks are still doing it with style and grace and just being really awesome. And I just really love that. Joe Walsh being another one. Well, the Eagles, for gosh sakes, they're not spring chickens either. So it's just really cool to see that. But I wanted to give a shout out to Blackmore and to Rainbow, because I think, you know, most people associate Rainbow, I mean, Blackmore rightfully so, with Deep Purple, but he's also done some really cool things with Blackmore's Rainbow, both what I would call more obscure things, like during the Dio years where he was doing mostly album-oriented stuff, and some of the more pop stuff during Since You've Been Gone and Stone Cold, and, you know, with Joel and Turner and Since You've Been Gone with... Graham Bonnet. And Graham has sung with Michael Schenker as well. Michael's had some pretty decent vocalists with him as well. And he's just a monster guitar player. He's out doing his thing now. He's been clean and sober for quite a number of years. So He still sounds really fat. And he's another one who's getting up in years and just playing like a monster. Just, I love to see that. That's just awesome. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Fabulous. Actually, I'm going to throw one more in there. You were talking about, you know, rockers. Unfortunately, this one is no longer with us, but I did want to mention that today is David Bowie's birthday. I don't know I have Facebook assistance to remember that. I have to be honest. But I thought that was kind of nice.
Okay. Well, cool.
So,
okay.
Homage to the great white Duke. And
there you go.
Give some applause to everybody else for all of their wonderful work. As always, awesome story. Fun things. I was going to ask you something real quick. We were talking earlier about Dave Coverdale. That's the guy that went to Whitesnake and married Tawny Catane for a while, wasn't it?
Well, it would, yeah, David Coverdale started Whitesnake after Deep Purple went under.
Yeah.
David Coverdale started Whitesnake with John Lord, the keyboardist for Deep Purple. And, you know, they played out for a while, and I think, and he used one of the guitar player for, and I can't think of his name, for Bernie Marsden, from Trapeze.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
Glenn Hughes' old band. Yes. I find the music business very incestuous in a good sort of way. I don't mean that in a bad way.
Yeah, right.
In terms of the musical stuff, yeah. And, of course, Coverdale's gone through a lot of people in the band and Whitesnake as well. But, yeah, Coverdale's still out there doing it with Whitesnake. I mean, he's done solo records and done Whitesnake as well. So he's still out there doing it, unfortunately. And this is certainly no disrespect to him. He's not he's kind of lost some of his highs, kind of like Don Dock, and he can't hit a lot of the highs anymore. And I'm really sad to hear that. I was glad to – I saw them on their last tour a couple of years ago, and he was still belting it out like a banshee. But his last record is missing some of the sparkle of the highs, and I suspect part of that's age, and part of that's the fact that he smokes cigarettes like a banshee, which I'm like, oh, come on,
yeah.
Dude, really?
Yeah.
I mean, if I had a voice like that, you would never catch me smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah.
I know earlier you had made a side comment about Linda Ronstadt as well, and I happened to catch a thing on Staples. She was. I caught a bio thing on, I don't know if it was PBS, who was carrying it, I can't remember. It was just this past Sunday night where they did, you know, The Sound of My Voice, which was a profile of her. And apparently she has extreme difficulty due to Parkinson's and is losing her voice.
Yeah,
still doing some
stuff
like with family and some of her old bandmates, but that is where she has wandered off to. I didn't know. I knew she was kind of semi-retired. I didn't really understand why until I saw the show. So that was bittersweet because it was a lot of good stuff. And then I found out what's going on with her now. And, you know, she's still trying to do her music,
sad.
But she's really struggling.
Yeah, so. It's very sad. She's her main guitar player through most of her career, Whitey Wachell, is also a monster player. And he's played with every flipping body on the planet. He's actually just a monster player, and actually one of the guys that was mentor to, what was the band that the Partridge Family was modeled after?
Oh, Lord.
He was the guy that,
when that came out.
I can't think of the name, but anyway, he was the head guy of that band. He was this guy's like mentor, hero, guitar teacher, whatever. So, I mean, Waddy's been around for a long time. Waddy has played with everybody from Linda Ronstadt to Jackson Browne to Warren Zevon, produced some of a lot of Warren's records. He's a guitar player, I think, on Worlds of London. And he's just, conducted the band, the Grammys award band a couple of years ago. He's a really, really, really hot player, really, really solid player, just awesome player.
I did not know this, but I went and Googled it while you were talking. The band the Partridge Family is based on was called the Cow Sills.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And I loved them when I was a child, but I didn't know about the Cow Sills until just now. So this is why we love to do the trivia part of the show. You learn stuff.
Yes. So Florence Henderson actually went and talked with them and met with them before she took the role on the Partridge Family.
Oh, cool. Well, it's good that they apparently signed off on being presented on there. That's good. And, yes, no bad blood.
Yeah. So Bud Caustill was a student and sort of devotee of Whitey Watchell back in the day.
See, like you said, incestuous, definite industry there. So,
yeah,
okay,
I'm telling you, these guys are all in the drama.
Yeah, you know, maybe we should do a family tree show sometime and be like, this one's connected to this one, and this one, and go back and forth. That could be very interesting. Okay, so let's go ahead and we'll be taking calls from listeners and questions in the online chat room if any of you guys are listening live throughout the evening until around midnight, our time. That's about a little over a half hour from now. Please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called 2 Minutes to Midnight, Terror Management Theory. So terror management theory is both a social and evolutionary psychology theory originally proposed by Jeff Greenberg, Sheldon Solomon, and Tom Pyszczynski, and codified in their 2015 book, The Worm at the Core, on the role of death in life. According to the APA dictionary, it's a theory proposing that control of death anxiety is the primary function of society and the main motivation in human behavior. So tonight we will discuss the history and explanation of terror management theory, cultural values and their role in terror management theory, rebuttals and related theories, and summary and resources. And I'm going to check in with you before we get started, Dr. Mathis, if there's anything you want to lead off with before we get started.
Nope, I'm good. Thanks.
All righty. So, history and explanation of terror management theory. So, what is terror management theory? We've been hearing about this. Summary of the original paper that led eventually to the 2015 book, Worm at the Core, on Role of Death in Life. So, the academic paper was called A Terror Management Theory of Social Behavior, The Psychological Functions of Self-Esteem and Cultural Worldviews. And that was by Sheldon Solomon, Jeff Greenberg, and Tom Pyszczynski. And it was an M.P. Zanna, M.P. Zanna was the editor for Advances in Experimental Social Psychology. That's an academic journal, volume 24, put out by Academic Press. I don't have access to the paper because it is academic, and I don't have access to that database, but they do have the publisher's summary, and this is what they said. This chapter deals with terror management theory that attempts to contribute to the understanding of social behavior by focusing on the essential being and circumstances of the human animal. The theory posits that all human motives are ultimately derived from a biologically based instinct for self-preservation. Relative equanimity in the face of these existential realities is possible through the creation and maintenance of culture, which serves to minimize the terror by providing a shared symbolic context that imbues the universe with order, meaning, stability, and permanence. The theory provides a theoretical link between superficially unrelated substantive areas and focuses on one particular motive that makes it distinctly human and, unfortunately, distinctly destructive. Theories serve a variety of equally important functions, all of which are oriented towards improving the ability to think about and understand the subject matter of discipline. The chapter discusses the dual component cultural anxiety buffer, worldview, and self-esteem. The development and functioning of the cultural anxiety buffer for the individual, and a terror management analysis of social behavior in great detail. And that is essentially the abstract for the original paper. Next explanation is from the APA dictionary, which says that terror management theory is a theory proposing that control of death anxiety is the primary function of society and the main motivation in human behavior. Accordingly, awareness of the inevitability of death, or mortality salience, motivates people to maintain faith in the absolute validity of the cultural worldviews, in other words, beliefs and values, that give their lives meaning, and to believe that they are living up to those standards, thus attaining a sense of personal value or self-esteem that buffers them against the frightening recognition of their own mortality. See also ontological confrontation. And this is based on the work of U.S. cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker, who died in 74. Psychology Today explains it as, terror management theory attempts to explain a type of defensive human thinking and behavior that stems from an awareness and fear of death. According to TMT, death anxiety drives people to adopt worldviews that protect their sense of self-esteem, worthiness, and sustainability, and allows them to believe that they play an important role in a meaningful world. Human survival instincts and the need to reinforce cultural significance in the face of death often result in displays of prejudice or the belief that the group with which one identifies is superior to other groups. In this way, people confirm their self-importance and insulate themselves from their deep fear of merely living an insignificant life permanently eradicated by death. TMT proposes that individuals are motivated to develop close relationships within their own cultural group in order to feel immortal, to convince themselves that they will somehow live on, if only symbolically, after their inevitable death. And these are some of the core tenets of terror management theory. First, fear of death is innate, universal, and unique to humans. And side note here, I kind of challenged the last assertion. We may have the fullest understanding of the intelligent species, but I'm not certain that humans are unique in their comprehension of death or the realization that it's happening. And we can talk about that in a hot second. Second, self-awareness feeds awareness of one's own inevitable demise. Third, fear of our own deaths is a root source of all human conflicts and anxieties and clashes with our primal instinct to survive. And last, the ultimate motive of terror management theory is to manage our terror so that we can function day to day, often by repression and denial of that knowledge. And with that, I'm going to pause here and check in with you, Dr. Mathis. And if you have any comments, and especially if you have anything to say about me poking the bear on item number one.
Well, I also think that we are definitely not the only species that's aware of that. I think there's other related species to us, primates in particular, who probably have an awareness of this. What I can tell you is that some of the tenets of this also relate very closely to existential psychology, which talks about one of the big four givens of existence is our own death and how we handle that being one of the hallmark characteristics of the healthy person versus the unhealthy person and how they manage that issue.
Yes, and we are going to talk about that some. I do have notes that this is definitely part of the history. We're going to talk about that actually in the very next section.
Now, there you have it.
So that's a great lead-in. So the next part I wanted to talk about is the history of terror management theory, because this, as a term and as a structure, is fairly new as these things go in the industry. It's not something that people have been hearing about for all that long. So terror management theory, as Dr. Mathis has pointed out, is related to existential psychology, which is a movement begun in reaction to Freud's theory. Some of you may have heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a pyramid diagram showing human priorities. Maslow is one of the earliest figures in the EP. Existential psychotherapy is a form of psychotherapy based on the model of human nature and experience developed by the existential tradition of European philosophy. It focuses on concepts that are universally applicable to human existence, including death, freedom, responsibility, and the meaning of life. instead of regarding human experiences such as anxiety, alienation, and depression as implying the presence of mental illness, existential psychotherapy sees these experiences as natural stages in a normal process of human development and maturation. In facilitating this process of development and maturation, existential psychotherapy involves a philosophical exploration of an individual's experiences, stressing the individual's freedom and responsibility to facilitate a higher degree of meaning and well-being in his or her life. Both Freud and existential psychology seek to address the motivations behind human behavior. Freud contends that the root motives are sex and aggression. Existentialists believe that the root motives are about seeking meaning and status out of a fear of our own inevitable end. Sheldon Solomon, Jeff Greenberg, and Todd Brzezinski wrote theoretical papers in 1986, which would become their 1991 scholarly paper, Terror Management Theory of Social Behavior, The Psychological Functions of Self-Esteem and Cultural Worldviews. Some history from the Wikipedia entry on terror management theory. TMT is derived from anthropologist Ernest Becker's 1973 Pulitzer Prize-winning work of nonfiction, The Denial of Death, in which Becker argues, most human action is taken to ignore or avoid the inevitability of death. The terror of absolute annihilation creates such a profound, albeit subconscious, anxiety in people that they spend their lives attempting to make sense of it. On large scale, societies build symbols, laws, religious meaning systems, cultures, and belief systems to explain the significance of life, define what makes certain characteristics, skills, and talents extraordinary, reward others whom they find exemplify certain attributes, and punish or kill others who do not adhere to their cultural worldview. On an individual level, self-esteem provides a buffer against death-related anxiety. Cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker asserted this in his 1973 book, that humans as intelligent animals are able to grasp the inevitability of death. They therefore spend their lives building and believing in cultural elements that illustrate how to make themselves stand out as individuals and give their lives significance and meaning. Death creates an anxiety in humans. It strikes at unexpected and random moments, and its nature is essentially unknowable, causing people to spend most of their time and energy to explain, forestall, and avoid it. Becker expounded upon the previous writings of Sigmund Freud, Søren Kierkegaard, Norman Brown, and Otto Rank. According to clinical psychiatrist Morton Levitt, Becker replaces the Freudian preoccupation with sexuality, with the fear of death, as the primary motivation in human behavior. People desire to think of themselves as beings of value and worth with a feeling of permanence, a concept in psychology known as self-esteem. This feeling counters the cognitive dissonance created by an individual's realization that they may be no more important than any other living thing. Becker refers to high self-esteem as heroism, and he says, quote, the problem of heroics is the central one of human life, that it goes deeper into human nature than anything else because it's based on organismic narcissism and on the child's need for self-esteem as a condition for his life. Society itself is a codified hero system, which means that society everywhere is a living myth of the significance of human life, a defiant creation of meaning, end quote. Self-esteem lies at the heart of TMT and is a fundamental aspect of its core paradigms. TMT fundamentally seeks to elucidate the causes and consequences of a need for self-esteem. Theoretically, it draws heavily from Becker's conceptions of culture and self-esteem. TMT not only attempts to explain the concept of self-esteem, it also tries to explain why we need self-esteem. One explanation is that self-esteem is used as a coping mechanism for anxiety. It helps people control their sense of terror and nullify the realization that humans are just animals trying to manage the world around them. According to TMT, self-esteem is a sense of personal value that is created by beliefs in the validity of one's cultural worldview and the belief that one is living up to the cultural standards created by that worldview. Next, mortality salience, which I mentioned earlier, is the awareness by an individual that their death is inevitable. And yes, this is a related concept. The mortality salience hypothesis, or MS, states that if indeed one's cultural worldview or one's self-esteem serves a death-denying function, then threatening these constructs should produce defenses aimed at restoring psychological equanimity. In other words, returning the individual to a state of feeling invulnerable. In the MS paradigm, these, quote, threats are simply experiential reminders of one's own death. This can and has taken many forms, many different forms, in a variety of study paradigms. For example, asking participants to write about their own death, conducting the experiment near funeral homes or cemeteries, having participants watch graphic depictions of death, etc. Like the other TMT hypotheses, the literature supporting the MS hypothesis is vast and diverse. For a meta-analysis of MS research, we're not going to get into tonight, see Burke et al. In 2010. There's a paper on. TMT posits that religion was created as a means for humans to cope with their own mortality. Supporting this, arguments in favor of life after death and simply being religious reduce the effects of mortality salience on worldview defense. Thoughts of death have also been found to increase religious beliefs. At an implicit subconscious level, this is the case even for people who claim to be non-religious. An individual's level of self-consciousness can affect their views on life and death. To a point, increasing self-consciousness is adaptive in that it helps prevent awareness of danger. However, research has demonstrated that there may be diminishing returns from this phenomenon. Individuals with higher levels of self-consciousness sometimes have increased death cognition and a more negative outview on life than those with reduced self-consciousness. And with that, I'm going to pause here on the history and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you'd like to add anything.
No, I'm okay, thanks.
All righty. Sneaking a cough drop while I'm waiting for you to talk. Caught me. All right, section number two, cultural values and the role in terror management theory. This is short and sweet. from the wiki, also, the most obvious examples of cultural values that assuage death anxiety are those that purport to offer literal immortality. For example, belief in the afterlife, religion, so on. However, TMT also argues that other cultural values, including those that are seemingly unrelated to death, offer symbolic immortality. For example, values of national identity, posterity, cultural perspectives on sex, and human superiority over animals have been linked to death concerns. In many cases, these values are thought to offer symbolic immortality, either A, by providing the sense that one is part of something greater that will ultimately outlive the individual, such as country, lineage, species. For example, this is why people do genealogy. Or B, by making one's symbolic identity superior to biological nature. In other words, you are a personality which makes you more than a glob of cells. Because cultural values determine that which is meaningful, they are also the foundation for self-esteem. TMT describes self-esteem as being the personal subjective measure of how well an individual is living up to their cultural values. And I will pause here and see if you would care to add anything to that, Dr. Mathis.
Well, I think it's also related to why we like, you know, authors, musicians, sculptors, painters, architects. You know, they build the pyramids, they build the Arc de Triomphe, they create great music or write great novels. You live on after you're gone. It's a form of symbolic immortality, just kind of like having kids.
I think that's a very good point. That is true. And I think a lot of people get attached to locations or symbols like that. You know, like, for example, when 9/11 happened and the Twin Towers came down, those were beacons of cultural, societal something for a lot of people. And, you know, people that don't even work there or do anything. So when you attack them, you know, people have these reactions, and that's related to what we're talking about tonight. So I definitely think that's true. And even the insubstantial things like, you know, songs and poems and stuff like that, you know, they're not things in the world, but that melody, you know, as long as you remember that song, you'd be driving in the car and you hear a song from your childhood and suddenly it's, you know, 30, 40 years ago. You know, it has a way of being timeless and kind of making you forget that you're not a child. You're just in this kind of moment where there is no time. And sometimes when we get anxious, we need that.
Yeah, I also think it's part of the reason why people are fascinated with paranormal psychology and paranormal events, because if you can document that the paranormal exists and document that ghosts and spirits exist, then you can document that there's life after death, and therefore you have a form of immortality.
I think that's absolutely true.
I mean, I can definitely tell you that was one of my motivations. Yeah, that was definitely one of my motivations for getting involved in study of paranormal phenomena, which I've been involved with for a long time. And that was definitely one of my motivations, because if you can look at stuff and go, wait a minute, you know, it's kind of like if you can prove, or, you know, to your satisfaction at least, that, you know, evil exists, that demons exist, that means that angels exist, and that means if demons exist, that means the devil exists, and that means God exists. So you're sort of back to that again, you know?
Yeah, it's a giant cascade of existing.
There you go.
Okay, so next I want to talk about rebuttals and related theories. And I'm just going to present these. I'm not necessarily making a case one way or the other. I'm just going to explore this. So these are from the wiki. First note is critically, Houston et al. In 2002, that was a paper, have questioned the causal direction between self-esteem and death anxiety, evaluating whether one's self-esteem comes from their desire to reduce their death anxiety or if death anxiety arises from a lack of self-esteem. So I guess it's chicken and egg, according to them. In other words, an individual's suppression of death anxiety might arise from their overall need to increase their self-esteem in a positive manner. Other criticisms of TMT. Psychologists, especially evolutionary psychologists, have argued against terror management theory. One scholar commented that the field of psychology would be advanced by a study of paralyzed states caused by anxiety that would only be alleviated with a reworking of a person's mental state. These authors instead explain human behavior is selected to urge people to avoid situations likely to lead to death. This suggests that mortality salience effects reflect adaptive responses to solve specific life threats, rather than an unconscious attempt to avoid this realization. Next, since findings on mortality salience and worldview defense were first published, other researchers have claimed that the effects may have been obtained due to reasons other than death itself, such as anxiety, fear, or other adversive stimuli, such as pain. Other studies have found effects similar to those that MS results in, for example, thinking about difficult personal choices to be made, being made to respond to open-ended questions regarding uncertainty, thinking about being robbed, thinking about being socially isolated, and being told that one's life lacks meaning. Next is MMM, the Meaning Maintenance Model, MMM, was initially introduced as a comprehensive motivational theory that claimed to subsume TMT, with alternative explanations for TMT findings. Essentially, it posits that people automatically give meaning to things, and I've done workshops about this before, you know, some large group awareness training style stuff, and basically humans are little meaning-making machines, we like to say, in those. So people give meaning to things, and when those meanings are somehow disrupted, it causes anxiety. TMT theorists argue that MMM cannot describe why different sets of meaning are preferred for a symbol by different people, and that while they may exist, quote, different, i.e. more concrete, types of meaning have different psychological functions, end quote. For example, MMM theorists argue that all types of meaning are basically equal, and yet one could not compare the likelihood of defensive responses resulting from exposure to a deck of cards containing black hearts with something like the September 11 attacks. TMT theorists argue essentially that unless something is an important element of a person's anxiety-buffering worldview or self-esteem, it will not require broad meaning maintenance. In sum, TMT theorists believe that MMM cannot accurately claim to be an alternative to TMT because it does not seem to be able to explain the current breadth of TMT evidence. As an example, TMT theorists assert that mortality salience would not be a threat to meaning, since our eventual demise is a necessary condition of life. Therefore, it should not cause an individual to engage in general meaning maintenance. MMM also makes no attempt to explain why threatening meaning increases DTA. Next is offensive defensiveness. That was kind of an odd way to put it. Some theorists have argued that it is not the idea of death or non-existence that is unsettling to people, but the fact that uncertainty is involved. For example, these researchers posited that people defend themselves by altering their fear responses from uncertainty to an enthusiasm approach. Other researchers argue for distinguishing fear of death from fear of dying, and therein posit that ultimately the fear of death has more to do with some other fear, like fear of pain, or reflects fear of the unknown. TMT theorists agree that uncertainty can be disconcerting in some cases, and it may even result in defense responses, but note that they believe in the inescapability of death and the possibility of its finality regarding one's existence is most unsettling. They ask, would death be any less frightening if you knew for certain that it would come next Tuesday at 5:15 p.m. and that your hopes for an afterlife were illusory? Would you rather be certain that death is the end or live with the uncertainty that it might not be? End quote. They also note that people actually seek out some types of uncertainty, and that being uncertain is not always very unpleasant. Next is evolutionary psychology, coalitional psychology, and TMT. Several critiques have been proposed against TMT from evolutionary psychologists for reasons including that fear is an adaptive response in individuals that has come about as a result of natural selection. Without these adaptations, human beings would never have been able to avoid maladaptive situations. Thus, it is unlikely that people would have psychological ways of slowing down anxiety. In response, TMT theorists argue that this critique is mixing up fear related to immediate danger with anxiety related to thoughts of threats that will or may occur eventually. Coalitional psychology, CP, is presented as another alternative to TMT, which proposes that there is an evolutionary tendency to seek safety in groups, or in other words, coalitions, as a reaction to adaptive threats. People already a part of coalition groups seek to protect their membership by exhibiting their value to the group. TMT theorists answer by arguing that CP first cannot account for the fact that virtually all cultures have a supernatural dimension. Two, it does not explain why cultural worldview defense is symbolic, involving allegiance to both the specific and general systems of abstract meaning unrelated to specific threats, rather than focused on the specific adaptive threats it supposedly evolved to deal with. Third, it dismisses TMT's dual process account of the underlying processes that generate MS effects without providing an alternative of any kind or attempting to account for the data relevant to this aspect of the TMT analysis. Fourth, the experiments testing hypotheses derived from CP do not provide compelling or unique support for CP. And fifth, it cannot account for a host of empirical findings supporting hypotheses derived from TMT that could never be deduced from CP. A related theory to this, anxiety buffer disruption theory, ABDT, is an application of terror management theory to explain an individual's reaction to a traumatic event, which leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. When a traumatic experience cannot be assimilated into a currently held cultural worldview, the anxiety buffering mechanisms are disrupted. ABDT argues that individuals face overwhelming anxiety, which leads to the symptoms of PTSD, including re-experiencing, hyperarousal, avoidance, and disassociation. The disassociation causes atypical responses to mortality salience compared to, with individuals who do not suffer from an anxiety buffer disruption. When the anxiety buffer disruption is mild, exaggerated coping responses such as rejecting or taking offense to other cultures is expected. When the anxiety buffer disruption is severe, there can be a total breakdown of coping mechanisms. The theory was proposed by Todd Pazinski, co-author mentioned above in the original paper, in conjunction with Palin Kasebier. And at this point, I'm going to pause and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, for comments.
I'm good, thanks.
I'm actually surprised at that one. I was pretty verbose.
Well, I thought you did a good job, so I mean, I have nothing to add. So why add something when I don't have anything?
I appreciate that. That's fine. Summary and resources. Not really so much on the resources. There isn't necessarily a right or wrong conclusion at the end of this discussion, but rather more to let our listeners know about this stance in order for them to better be able to understand themselves and empower themselves to adjust and improve as they see fit. Terror management theory as a movement and psychological stance is still a work in progress and under some debate in the psychological community. Terror management theory is certainly not the final word on our final hours. But most self-aware adults do tend to seek some form of understanding and control over their impulses and motivations. So hopefully tonight's topic can become one more tool in that arsenal for self-improvement. And is there anything that you would care to add to that?
Yeah, just that, you know, I think everybody has to make their own decision. And whatever gets them through the night and whatever gets them closer to a better version of themselves works for me.
Fabulous. Okay. So in summary, we hope now that our listeners now know and understand this relatively new concept called terror management theory and can be cognizant of how the conscious and subconscious awareness of our collective mutual inevitable mortality, may affect a wide variety of our life choices, boundaries, and priorities. So this concludes our show on that topic. Is there anything further that you would like to add about any of the sections in closing?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. Dr. Mathis will be out of town for our next time slot, so we will see you guys in February 2020 with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, February 5th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. Please feel free to tune in for an encore presentation of one of our previous shows on the January 22nd time slot. I don't know which one yet, but I'm pretty sure that it will be something fun. I'm going to leave that up to the head of NDB Media to pick. Speaking of NDB Media, we'd like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. Travel Itch Radio tomorrow night, the 9th, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The best way to appreciate the climate and legacy of San Diego is to jump on the Old Town Trolley, offering a variety of narrated expeditions that stretch from downtown to Coronado and beyond. Hear all about the choices from Rod LaBranche of Historic Tours of America when he leads off the 2020 Travel Itch radio season as Dan Schlossberg and new host Keita Roberts interview Rod in the 348th episode of Travel Itch Radio, beginning its ninth season. Next up is Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, this Saturday, January 11th, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And since I'm pretty sure Roger Noriega is probably at least co-hosting this, that's going to be 6 in the goddamn morning for you, buddy. Good luck to you with that. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. No one is safe while we troll the digital airwaves. Join us as we discuss the latest news in the world of sports and review the events of the past week. No fantasy sports here. We keep it real. You need to remember, we kill brain cells, and as such, we must just be the purveyors of the zombie apocalypse. Oh, Roger. You have been warned. And by the way, their chat room is no more. Blog Talk Radio has been doing some funky things with the chat room format. We are currently still using ours, but these guys will not be. So you can find them active on the Facebook page for the show, and you can chat with them there. The Walking Dead online viewing party that I co-host, or host now, is on hiatus in conjunction with the TV show, and will be returning for Season 10, Episode 9, on Sunday, February 23rd. So please come back and join us then. And as for the Rock and Roll Shrink, please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you, and rock on.